American Free Press Audio Edition, Number 1 and 2, December 31, 2018 and January 7, 2019. A good start. AFP applauds pulling U.S. troops out of Syria, Afghanistan and every other nation possible, by Dr. Ron Paul. We all had a big shock in late December when, seemingly out of the blue, President Donald Trump announced that he was removing U.S. troops from Syria and would draw down half of the remaining U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The president told us the troops were in Syria to fight ISIS and, with ISIS nearly gone, the Syrians and their allies could finish the job. All of a sudden, the Trump haters, who for 2 years had been telling us that the president was dangerous because he might get us in a war, were telling us that the president is dangerous because he was getting us out of a war. These are the same people who have been complaining about the president's historic effort to help move toward peace with North Korea. There was more than a little hypocrisy among the never-Trump resistance over the president's announcement. Many of the talking heads and politicians who attacked George W. Bush's wars, then were silent for President Barack Obama's wars, are now attacking Trump for actually taking steps to end some wars. It just goes to show that for many who make their living from politics and the military-industrial complex, there are seldom any real principles involved. Among the neoconservatives, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's reaction was pretty typical, though it seems Graham is never bothered when presidents violate the Constitution to take the U.S. into another war without authorization. He cannot tolerate it when a president follows the Constitution and removes U.S. troops from wars they have no business being involved in. Graham is now threatening to hold congressional hearings in an attempt to reverse the president's decision to remove troops from Syria. Neoconservatives are among the strongest proponents of the idea that as a unitary executive, the president should not be encumbered by things like the Constitution when it comes to war-making. Now, all of a sudden, when a president uses his actual constitutional authority to remove troops from a war zone, the neocons demand congressional meddling to weaken the president. They get it wrong on both fronts. The president does have constitutional authority to move U.S. troops and to remove U.S. troops. Congress has the power and the obligation to declare war and the power of the purse to end wars. Most of the Washington establishment, especially the resistance liberals and the neocons, are complaining that by removing U.S. troops from these two war zones Trump has gone too far. I would disagree with them. I call Trump's announcement a good start. Americans are tired of being the world's policemen. The United States does not lose influence by declining to get involved in disputes oceans away. We lose influence by spending more on the military than most of the rest of the world combined and meddling where we are not wanted. We will lose a whole lot more influence when their crazy spending makes us bankrupt. Is that what they want? We should pay attention to Washington's wild reaction to Trump's announcement. The vested interests do not want us to have any kind of peace dividend because they have become so rich on the war dividend. Meanwhile, the middle class is getting poorer, and we're all less safe. Let's hope Trump continues these moves to restore sanity in our foreign policy. That would really make America great again. APERSONALMESSAGEFROMTHEEDITOR. Give peace a chance. Support troop withdrawals. It's the start of a new year here at American Free Press, and we can't tell you how happy we are to be leading off 2019 with some fantastic news. On December 19th, a week before Christmas, President Donald Trump gave us all a wonderful present by announcing that he was bringing home the remaining 2,000 U.S. troops currently illegally occupying a remote, northeastern portion of the war-torn country. On the day, the president announced to the world, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there during the Trump presidency." The news that American GIs would finally be coming home after what had been a terrible and bloody insurrection in that once stable Middle Eastern nation should have been celebrated around the country in the lead up to the holidays, not in the nation's capital, though. The response from the moneyed elite was quick and, to be honest, pretty shocking. Of course, CNN was quick out of the gate to call Trump's move bizarre and a mistake. The liberal cable news network, which has seen its viewership drop but its profit margin ballooned due to its incessant promotion of fake news hit pieces on Trump and his family, claimed the policy shift would fail our allies and embolden our enemies. The next day, the New York Times editorial board called the decision abrupt and dangerous. The Washington Post laid it on even thicker, saying Trump destroyed U.S. policy in the Middle East. Even Fox News fired shots at Trump. Brian Kilmeade, a co-host on Fox and Friends, a show that is normally supportive of the president, called the decision totally irresponsible. In fact, after looking through the headlines of major newspapers and other media outlets, we couldn't find any positive coverage of the president's decision. And it wasn't just liberal Democrats blasting the president this time. Even his fellow Republicans took shots at him. Senator Marco Rubio, RFLA, warned, "It is a major blunder." Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC, a retired Air Force judge advocate who never saw combat in his life, took to the Senate floor to excoriate Trump for having the audacity to bring U.S. troops home. "This is a stain on the honor of the United States," Graham said in a tirade on the Senate floor. "I hope and pray the president will reconsider this. I know that every national security advisor understands that the time is not right to withdraw. If he does not decide to reconsider, then it will be incumbent upon the Congress to speak and hold him accountable." To his credit, Trump responded reasonably and rationally to all of the vitriol, saying, "Why are we fighting for our enemy, Syria, by staying and killing ISIS for them, Russia, Iran, and other locals? Time to focus on our country and bring our youth back home where they belong." A short while later, Trump further riled up the swamp when he spoke of bringing 7,000 U.S. troops home from Afghanistan as well. After fighting for nearly two decades, the longest war in the history of the United States, to hold on to a tiny portion of a mountainous country, it's long past time to call an end to the conflict and leave the chaotic place to the tribes that call it home. It's worth noting that a survey conducted by professional polling company Rasmussen on December 27 found that 37% of Americans support the president's decision. Interestingly, in spite of the barrage of negative coverage, only 47% disagreed with the president's decision. Another 16% said they were not sure. But you wouldn't know that voters are split and that such a sizable portion of the U.S. population agrees with the president if all you looked at were major newspapers and cable news. That is all the more reason to read American Free Press, the last real national newspaper in the United States. The best thing Trump can do to make America great again is to stop these ridiculous interventions that did not serve the country's national interests and bring our troops home. The most important thing on earth today should be peace and goodwill toward men. Read our columns by Dr. Ron Paul, Phil Giraldi, and others for more on this subject in this week's issue. H. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, U.S. Soldiers Talk About Border Efforts. AFP Reporter Speaks Candidly with U.S. Troops Departing Mexican Border, Donna, Texas. When active duty U.S. Army troops in mid-December began departing Hidalgo County, Texas, as part of a general drawdown of troops assigned to assist the Border Patrol, a half dozen soldiers who were part of the encampment near the Donna International Bridge, about 50 miles west of Brownsville, said they had mixed feelings about their assignment, especially in terms of being ordered to this location between the Thanksgiving and Christmas holidays. "I just got back from Germany and was soon sent here out of Fort Riley, Kansas," one of the soldiers told his writer, with the understanding that his name and those of his fellow soldiers would be withheld. "I only had a little while to see my wife and kids, and then I had to come here. I want to get back to see them and do some deer hunting." However, when asked about the mission, a rather rare one where the regular American military, under orders from President Donald Trump, guarded the border of the homeland rather than foreign borders, the soldiers lit up about that viewpoint. "We help the people in those caravans when we've got people right here in our own country, U.S. citizens, who are hungry and cannot get the help given to the migrants," one soldier remarked. And all the soldiers concurred that directly guarding their own nation on its home soil is something of a novelty, though a welcome one, since that's really what having a military is all about, even in this age of America as world policemen. Having camped about 8 weeks at this southern Texas location, They understood that one possible reason they were leaving is that all of the significant caravans of Central Americans ended up veering well west of the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, in which Donna is centrally located, opting to head toward California, where thousands of migrants have been languishing just outside the U.S. in the city of Tijuana, Mexico. AFP's John Friend assessed the situation on the ground there in AFP's prior edition. One of the Texas soldiers surmised that, ironically, the control the drug cartels exert on Mexico's state of Tamaulipas, right across the border from them, may have had a dampening effect on the caravans. If the people who comprise certain caravans enter Tamaulipas but lack money and other assets with which to appease the cartels in order to buy their protection, then the caravans will steer clear of Tamaulipas, as the soldier understands the situation. However, he heard that an entire busload of migrants may have tried to travel across Tamaulipas but ominously disappeared. The soldiers installed considerable amounts of concertina wire while they were in and around Donna. This writer observed large trucks loaded with uniformed soldiers tooling around the area while getting thumbs up from many residents. Other residents told local news outlets that they thought the troop deployment was a waste of money or otherwise unnecessary. It's worth noting that the droves of winter Texans who escaped the snow and cold to bask in deep South Texas almost universally support the deployment, judging from their patriotic displays at Donna's Dunwest Flea Market and the pro-military memorials at the dozens of cozy RV parks where the snowbirds dwell, dance, swim, and picnic among the palm trees. Many of those residents, who hail from across the U.S. as well as Canada, are veterans themselves. According to various news reports, as logistics troops and army engineers went down their mission of fortifying ports of entry for the Border Patrol, army and marine engineers have installed about 3/4 of the obstacles they had planned to install, consisting not only of concertina wire, but also of concrete barriers and large shipping containers to function as obstacles at ports of entry, all of which suggests, right when President Donald Trump is fighting for border wall money, that a permanent, properly designed wall would function as a dependable replacement for such temporary, makeshift physical obstacles and free up troops and border agents to focus their resources and energies into other, more fruitful aspects of border security. Once we get the rest of the obstacles built, we don't need to keep all those engineers here, Army Lieutenant General Jeffrey Buchanan, who leads the U.S. Northern Command's land forces, told the news journal Politico. This deployment represented the first time in recent history that regular active duty troops, rather than state-controlled National Guard units, were summoned to guard the border. In 1916, General John J. Pershing's forces were sent to Texas, as well as New Mexico and Arizona, to repel the border raids of political revolutionary Francisco Pancho Villa, a deployment that included the services of a young Robert R. McCormick, who would become the legendary Chicago Tribune publisher opposed to sending soldiers to guard foreign borders but never their own borders. Capital H. French press calls on former foe for help. Average Frenchmen say they can't make ends meet under existing system. By St. Patrick, with Paris flooded by protesters, tension, and turmoil, President Emmanuel Macron has turned to an unlikely source for counsel. Within the last 3 weeks, the leftist Macron has sought input from former conservative French President Nicolas Sarkozy. Sarkozy was in office from 2007 to 2012. Before being defeated by Socialist Party candidate François Hollande by a narrow margin, Sarkozy guided France through the global recession of 2008 and the Arab Spring of 2010. A former Minister of the Budget and Minister of Finances, Sarkozy, a hardliner on law and order, is well equipped to aid Macron in navigating through the protests that have taken over Parisian streets. Yellow vest protesters have demonstrated in some of the most posh districts of Paris in recent weeks. The yellow vests have called for the resignation of Macron as president, as well as lower fuel prices, a higher minimum wage, and a lower national tax burden on the middle and poorer classes. Quite unlike the American Republicans, the French right is now steeped heavily in populism. In the U.S., the GOP has convinced its middle-class voters to back policies that place the desires of billionaires over an improved cost of living, for example, the French right. However, represents the majority of the yellow vests, named after the 2008 law that required French motorists to carry a yellow vest in their vehicles. Their chief concern is a worsening daily condition for those who work full-time. The French right wing still stings from the loss of their candidate, Marine Le Pen of the National Rally Party. At 39, Macron became the youngest French president in history. The middle class and those on the right who had voted for Mrs. Le Pen, however, did not lose their passion for the issues because the results of an election were announced. Many of them have taken to the streets and have refused to allow the status quo to continue to rule France. There have already been concessions by the Macron government. An agreement was made that the new gas tax would be cancelled and a six-month moratorium on gas price changes would be installed. The minimum wage will be raised significantly by 2019, and the tax on overtime hours and annual bonuses would be eliminated. There are historical problems with Macron, of which the yellow vests are fully aware. He has always had his mind on government. He graduated with a Master's of Public Affairs and studied at a college founded for French civil servants. More importantly, he was a banker. But he was not just any investment banker. Macron honed his trade under the watchful eye of the Rothschild family at Rothschild & Sebank. His policies have enriched those who control the industries that receive financing from those banks. If the French elite win, Rothschild & Sebank wins. The French have shown that they are wise enough to fight these policies en masse. Sarkozy can also be an ally at the bargaining table. He was once called upon to mediate between Russia and Georgia in 2008. Whether Macron, currently hovering around a 20% approval rating, can ameliorate the concerns of the youngstridden voters in the new year is anyone's guess. Can he convince those hurting and struggling to make short-term sacrifices in an effort to achieve long-term growth? Americans could learn something from the yellow vests. It is easy to sit in front of the big screen television and scoff at those protesting around the world. There was once a time in America where citizens also took to the streets to protest taxes, mercantilism, tariffs, and tea. Yet the yellow vest movement is spreading. Yellow vest marches have sprung up throughout Europe and beyond, from Italy to Serbia, from Egypt to Canada. Safety vest-clad protesters are marching in an attempt to bring attention to rising energy prices, lower comparable wages, and economic uncertainty. The French workweek is 40% shorter than it was in the 1950s, and it isn't because the workers want to sip champagne along the shores of the Seine. The tax structure in France has become so burdensome that it has depressed the drive to work. Atlas has shrugged in Paris, and the take line is now more attractive and profitable than the line of givers. Corporate madness, the new normal. 3,800 stores set to close in 2019, but don't expect executive bonuses to decrease. By Donald Jeffries. Corporate America, along with pliable and ineffective politicians, has destroyed U.S. industry with horrendous trade deals and cheap foreign labor. They have done the same thing to retail operations nationwide. Hedge fund managers and investment analysts have supplanted company presidents who often had a personal or familial stake in their businesses. Despite his campaign rhetoric to the contrary, companies are moving offshore at a record pace under President Donald Trump, and the H-1B visa worker program, which could have been ended with the stroke of a presidential pen, still lives. Recently, a bankruptcy judge approved a plan by Sears to award over $25 million in bonuses to the executives who presided over the company's bankruptcy proceedings in October. Once Sears Holding Corporation took over Kmart in 2004, stores began closing regularly all over the country. In an egregious example of corporate welfare in 2011, Sears Holding Corporation threatened to move its headquarters out of Illinois, as NFL team owners often do, before being granted a lucrative $275 million subsidy package by the state. 11 days after getting this taxpayer largesse, Sears announced the closing of 120 stores nationwide. As of the end of 2018, Sears Holding Corporation is in the process of closing 188 more. This didn't stop them from handing out $25 million in executive bonuses. Under a globalist, predatory system, there is little competition and a startling culture of incompetence. Executive compensation seems to be the only thing that counts. Executive bonuses are permitted, often ludicrously, to be labeled performance-based, which became essentially tax-free in 1993. The Trump administration's tax reforms of 2017 rather shockingly eliminated the deduction for performance-based executive bonuses. Such bonuses were rarely earned and, in many cases, belied the utter failure of the lucky recipient. Golden parachutes became extremely popular in the corporate world of the 1990s, and by the 2000s they were all the rage. While CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina oversaw the significant decline of the company and instituted massive layoffs. Asked to leave in 2005, Ms. Fiorina was given an astounding $40 million to basically go away. Incensed by the payout, HP stockholders filed a class action lawsuit, which a federal judge predictably dismissed in April 2008. Somehow emboldened by her failure, Ms. Fiorina became a top advisor to Senator John McCain, R.R.'s, and then actually ran for president herself in 2016. Several golden parachutes are known to have been larger than $100 million. Topping them all was the $417 million given to longtime General Electric CEO Jack Welch. Welch oversaw several years where the corporate giant paid no taxes whatsoever, but he also was mired in personal corruption. Now GE is on the verge of collapse. AT&T is earning record profits and expects some $20 billion in savings from Trump's tax reforms, yet continues to shut down call centers across the country, in favor of moving offshore to lower salary locations like Mexico, India, and the Philippines. In December 2017, AT&T memorably announced generous bonuses for all its employees in the wake of the new tax package. What they neglected to mention is that the union had already negotiated these bonuses. While CEO Randall Stephenson promised to invest $1 billion in the United States to create some 7,000 hard hat jobs that make $70,000 to $80,000 per year, the company has actually laid off an estimated 7,000 employees since that announcement. The union filed an unfair labor practice claim against AT&T over its failure to disclose its plans regarding new tax reinvestments in May 2018, declaring, "We don't feel confident in what AT&T tells us." Comcast, like AT&T, boasted of giving bonuses already decided upon before the new tax package, and then celebrated by laying off 500 members of its sales department just before the Christmas holiday. Trump, who certainly understands the nuances of bankruptcy law, chastised Sears Holding Corporation in October for being improperly run and called the bankruptcy a shame. He noted, "Somebody that is of my generation, Sears, Roebuck was a big deal." Trump's Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin sat on the Sears board of directors during the time it was being improperly run. Reflecting upon the general demise of retail in America, Business Insider noted in October, "The retail apocalypse has descended on America. More than 3,800 stores are expected to close across the country this year. Department stores like Macy's, Sears, and JCPenney, and retailers including Toys R Us, BCBG, Abercrombie & Fitch, and Bay have decided to close dozens of stores." Sears isn't the only company that is struggling to adjust to the rise of e-commerce and the fall of foot traffic. With vacancy rates continuing to rise, walking through a mall in 2018 is like walking through a graveyard. Store closings are part of the new normal in America, along with stagnant employee wages, foreign workers, offshore production, and ever-increasing executive compensation. Know your rights or you'll lose the majority of American public. Elected officials show shocking level of civic illiteracy. By John Whitehead, "The government is pushing us ever closer to a constitutional crisis. What makes the outlook so much bleaker is the utter ignorance of the American people, and those who represent them, about their freedoms, history, and how the government is supposed to operate." As Morris Berman points out in his book Dark Ages America, 70% of American adults cannot name their senators or congressmen. More than half don't know the actual number of senators, and nearly a quarter cannot name a single right guaranteed by the First Amendment. 63% cannot name the three branches of government, Other studies reveal that uninformed or undecided voters often vote for the candidate whose name and packaging, for example, logo, are the most powerful. Color is apparently a major factor in their decision, more than government corruption and ineptitude, police brutality, terrorism, gun violence, drugs, illegal immigration or any other so-called danger that threatens our nation. Civic illiteracy may be what finally pushes us over the edge. As Thomas Jefferson warned, no nation can be both ignorant and free. Unfortunately, the American people have existed in a technology-laden, entertainment-fueled, perpetual state of cluelessness for so long that civic illiteracy has become the new normal for the citizenry. It's telling that Americans were more able to identify Michael Jackson as the composer of a number of songs than to know that the Bill of Rights was the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. In fact, most immigrants who aspire to become citizens know more about national civics than native-born Americans. Surveys indicate that half of native-born Americans couldn't correctly answer 70% of the civics questions on the U.S. citizenship test. Not even the government bureaucrats who are supposed to represent us know much about civics, American history and geography, or the Constitution, although they take an oath to uphold, support, and defend the Constitution against enemies foreign and domestic. For instance, a couple attempting to get a marriage license was recently forced to prove to a government official that New Mexico is, in fact, one of the 50 states and not a foreign country. You can't make this stuff up. Here's a classic example of how surreal the landscape has become. Just in time for Bill of Rights Day on December 15th, President Donald Trump issued a proclamation affirming the importance of the Bill of Rights in guarding against government abuses of power. The Founding Fathers understood the real threat government can pose to the rights of the people. That is why those first 10 amendments to the Constitution, among others, protected the right to speak freely, the right to freely worship, the right to keep and bear arms, the right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures, and the right to due process of law. As a part of the Constitution, the supreme law of the land, the Bill of Rights has protected our rights effectively against the abuse of government power for 227 years. Since there will always be a temptation for government to abuse its power, we reaffirm our commitment to defend the Bill of Rights and uphold the Constitution. Don't believe it for a second. The government doesn't want its abuses checked, and it certainly doesn't want its powers restricted. Guard against government the Bill of Rights, 462 words that represent the most potent and powerful rights ever guaranteed to a group of people officially, became part of the Constitution on December 15, 1791. Because early Americans such as James Madison and Thomas Jefferson understood the need to guard against the government's inclination to abuse its power, yet the reality we must come to terms with is that in the America we live in today, the government does whatever it wants. Make no mistake, if our individual freedoms have been restricted, it is only so that the government's powers could be expanded at our expense. The USA Patriot Act, passed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, drove a stake through the heart of the Bill of Rights, violating at least 6 of the 10 original amendments, the 1st, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th and 8th amendments, and possibly the 13th and 14th amendments, as well. The Patriot Act also redefined terrorism so broadly that many non-terrorist political activities such as protest marches, demonstrations, and civil disobedience were considered potential terrorist acts, thereby rendering anyone desiring to engage in protected First Amendment expressive activities as suspects of the surveillance state. Since 9/11, we've been spied on by surveillance cameras, eavesdropped on by government agents, had our belongings searched, our phones tapped, our mail opened, our email monitored, our opinions questioned, our purchases scrutinized. Under the USA Patriot Act, banks are required to analyze your transactions for any patterns that raise suspicion and to see if you are connected to any objectionable people, and our activities watched. We've also been subjected to invasive pat-downs and whole body scans of our persons and seizures of our electronic devices in the nation's airports and at border crossings. We can't even purchase certain cold medicine at the pharmacy anymore without it being reported to the government and our names being placed on a watch list. government surveillance, militarized police, SWAT team raids, asset forfeiture, eminent domain, overcriminalization, armed surveillance drones, whole body scanners, stop and frisk searches, all sanctioned by Congress, the White House, the courts, and the like, etc. These are merely the weapons of the police state. Meekly obey the power of the police state is dependent on a populace that meekly obeys without question. Remember, when it comes to the staggering loss of civil liberties, the Constitution hasn't changed. Rather, it is the American people who have changed. Those who gave us the Constitution and the Bill of Rights believe that the government exists at the behest of its citizens. The government's purpose is to protect, defend and even enhance our freedoms, not violate them. It is no idle happenstance that the Constitution opens with these three powerful words: "We the people." Those who founded this country knew quite well that every citizen must remain vigilant or freedom would be lost. As Thomas Paine recognized, it is the responsibility of the patriot to protect his country from its government. You have no rights unless you exercise them. There is a movement underway to require that all public school students pass the civics portion of the U.S. naturalization test, 100 basic facts about U.S. history and civics, before receiving their high school diploma. And that's a start. Mind you, it's only the first of many steps. If there is to be any hope for restoring our freedoms and reclaiming our runaway government, we will have to start by breathing life into those three powerful words that set the tone for everything that follows in the Constitution: "We the people." National Security Council advisor involved in Iran hostage crisis speaks with AFP. Former presidential aide says America's Iran policy is fatally flawed. By Dave Gallery. Gary Sick, President Jimmy Carter's principal White House aide for Persian Gulf Affairs and National Security Council, NSC, advisor on Iran during the Iranian Revolution and hostage crisis, sat down with this reporter to discuss those events, their impact on today's relations with the Islamic Republic, and current U.S. policy on Iran. Sick, who in 1985 wrote "All Fall Down: America's Tragic Encounter with Iran," from a policy standpoint, to document his experiences during that time, was a U.S. naval officer for 24 years, the last six of which were spent at the NSC. Sick was asked how the situation went from one in which the two countries were so closely aligned to the United States becoming the Great Satan in such a short amount of time, after 1953. When the United States conspired together with the British to put the Shah back on the throne, that was the genesis of our current troubles with Iran, Sick explained, contributing to the rapid switch from ally to Great Satan, and the easy overthrow of 2,500 years of Persian monarchy, was the direct relationship the U.S. had with the last Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The United States was dealing with the Shah directly as the representative of Iran, not with the government, with really the country of Iran, explained Sick. It was with that one man. The revolution began in January 1978, and it was over when the Shah fled the country in January 1979. So, in a 12-month period, explained Sick, we went from having a relationship with an individual to having no individual there to have a relationship with, and a very hostile government that replaced the Shah, which saw the United States as very much part of what they were opposing. Another factor that led to the ascendancy of the caliphate, besides the utter failure of U.S. intelligence to foresee the power of religion, was the Shah's machinations with Iran's military. The Shah very carefully made sure that his military forces were at odds with each other, explained Sick. So he appointed the heads of the different services to people who hated each other and who absolutely would not work together. After he left the country, the only institution that was left that might in fact have maintained the monarchy and the relationship with the United States was the military. Because of how the Shah had manipulated the military, it made it almost impossible for the different branches to work together after he fled, and so the military collapsed, explained Sick. And when the military collapsed, the Khomeini people and the revolution took over. The hostage crisis, although an outgrowth of the revolution, was a unique event. The United States discovered that the Shah of Iran was deathly ill, and there was tremendous pressure brought on Jimmy Carter to bring him to the United States for medical attention, explained Sick. The pressure, as revealed in All Fall Down, was applied by characters well known to readers of this newspaper, who were asked to help secure the safety of the American hostages by convincing the Shah to postpone his travel to the United States. David Rockefeller, chairman of Chase Manhattan Bank, and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, both intimates of the Shah, refused to cooperate. Since the Shah had been a close friend of the United States, T.O. refused him admittance, even at the admitted risk of U.S. lives, would be a national disgrace, was Rockefeller's and Kissinger's stance, states the book. Of course, Rockefeller's concern wasn't just for the Shah, as Sick explained to this reporter. For years the Shah had been placing most of his assets in Chase Manhattan Bank with David Rockefeller, he said, so a tremendous amount of Iranian wealth was in U.S. banks. It wasn't just Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan, the Shah had been taking out loans over many years, Sick explained, and those loans were syndicated, so different banks all over the world had a certain responsibility or a certain exposure to those loans. Ultimately, Carter caved to the big banks and let the Shah in. That very fateful decision that was made by Carter, against his better judgment, turned out to be the turning point, explained Sick. The seizure of the U.S. Embassy was next, but it unfolded in a way no one could predict. The students who decided to take the embassy, explained Sick, did that with the understanding, they thought, that they were there for a sit-in. They would make a political point, saying that the Shah should be returned to Iran for trial, and then they thought the government would intervene and say, all right, you've made your point, now it's time to go home, and instead the government joined them in their opposition. And that turned it into an international crisis that actually ran for 444 days. Very few realized the Iranian revolution almost failed to take hold, as most Iranians didn't want to stray too far from the monarchy, many of whom had marched in the streets for greater freedom, greater human rights for women, and were not all that enthusiastic about the fact that they were going to have a theocratic state ruled by the clergy, he said. Khomeini was worried that his revolution was going to go off the rails, added Sick, and as he saw that faltering, the hostage crisis came along just at the moment when he could create a crisis with the United States, which, wrapping all of the Iranian people around him, it put aside all of these questions of the theocratic regime, and by the time the hostage crisis was solved, he was firmly in power. One area where Sick gets it wrong in his book is his prediction for a quick collapse of the theocracy, where he writes that the Iranian revolution was very likely to experience a major crisis of legitimacy at some point in its future, and that crisis was likely to occur when the system could no longer depend on the charisma and authority of Khomeini, the supreme leader of Iran. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini died in 1989, but the regime is still going strong. The regime is remarkably resilient, he said. It has stood up against tremendous pressure. It has fought a war against a really difficult opponent, the Iraqis, who in fact had help from the United States and others. Iran has been isolated for years, and despite all of that, they have survived. So, I no longer make predictions about the fact that Iran is going to fall. I think that is a fool's errand, Sick warned about the U.S. pushing for regime change in Iran. The operation of outside forces tends to bring Iranians together and delegitimizes any efforts for change, he explained. So, by pushing Iran extremely hard, instead of getting Iran to fall, the tendency is we actually strengthen it, he continued. The lesson, which unfortunately I think the present government in the United States really has not learned, and which I think the Obama administration, for all of the faults and problems that it had, it did understand, that basically by bringing Iran into a closer association with the rest of the world, it delegitimized the regime and brought closer the day in which that regime would go. I think we're actually, at this point, strengthening the regime instead of harming it. Progressives resist ending the wars, pulling troops out of Syria is manifestly good, so why all the bipartisan condemnation? By Philip Giraldi, liberal interventionists in the media wants America's wars to continue forever. Last Thursday I actually turned on PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff, which I never watch, but the other offerings on television were dismal, and I was flipping channels. She had on as guests her regular commentator Mark Shields and Michael Gerson of The Washington Post. Shields is a hardcore liberal and Gerson is a neoconservative longtime critic of Donald Trump, presumably filling in for regular PBS conservative David Brooks. The discussion was about Syria and the resignation of Secretary of Defense James Mattis. Woodruff had the pathologically ambitious Senator Marco Rubio, our flaw, on earlier, which was a bullet I quite happily dodged. He reportedly said that Trump was about to make a major blunder on Syria, aligning him with fellow Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, SC, who said pretty much the same thing. Given the fact that NPR has a Bobo audience that it answers to, I fully expected that there would be a lot of tap dancing about the events of the week, but was somewhat surprised to hear nothing but damnation from Shields and Gerson about how the Trump move would a grave if not fatal damage to U.S. national security and how the president, unlike seasoned patriot Mattis, cannot distinguish right from wrong. Gerson said, "You know, you look at Mattis's resignation letter, which coldly and rationally said to the president, you do not understand our friends, and you do not understand our enemies, as America's self-defined friends in the Middle East might best be described as frenemies." I was wondering if either Shields or Gerson, or Rubio, ever venture past the comics pages of their daily newspapers. As they all spend their time in Washington, that newspaper would be the Washington Post, which perhaps explains things, as the paper's vitriol against Trump and the Syria move has been astonishing by any measure. In other words, the PBS coverage of a major story was all pure improvisation, straight out of the establishment playbook, and Woodruff wasn't even canny enough to push back. Getting out of Syria and hopefully eventually Afghanistan is the best thing that Trump has done for America so far, if he has the guts to actually do it. Both are wars that were unnecessary from day one and are now unwinnable in any real way. They largely keep going fueled by the lies coming from friends like Saudi Arabia and Israel, aided and abetted by the defense contractor community and the Quislings in Congress who are willing to sell out completely to the military industrial complex because it creates jobs in their constituencies. When I could take no more, I flipped channels and Democracy Now! Came up, another program I find nearly as loathsome for its sumptuous goodliness as PBS News. Amy Goodman fortunately had history professor Andrew Bacevich on, and he explained, citing the general's letter of resignation, how Mattis, when he talked about his 4 decades of engagement with these matters, is very telling. He represents the establishment's perspective that has evolved over the course of those 4 decades. And for anyone who says, who looks at U.S. policy over the past 4 decades, particularly in the Middle East, and says, yeah, it's really gone well, then I would think that they would view Mattis's resignation as a disappointment. Now, when Trump ran for the presidency, he denounced our wars in the Middle East. He promised to withdraw militarily from the Middle East. 2 years into his presidency, that hasn't happened, and in many respects, Mattis has been among those who have frustrated the president's efforts. Now, I'm in the camp who thinks that we ought to wind down these wars, that we've got more important things to do. Bacevich also pointed out that the prevailing establishment foreign policy is both morally and practically wrong and unsustainable. He hoped that Trump would prevail against the tremendous pressure that is being exerted against him to recant. I said bravo and turned off the TV. Here is my problem with liberals like Shields and neocons like Gerson. They hate Trump so much that they will do anything to bring him down, even when he is doing something that is manifestly good for the country. Gerson at least is consistent in that he hates Trump and likes America's wars. But what about Shields and Woodruff? You would think that ending a conflict in which most of the casualties are civilians would be praised by them in the broader social justice warrior community. But where are the liberals supporting Trump on this bold step to disengage from endless and pointless war in the Middle East, either in the media or among the politicians and punditry? MSNBC's resident progressive screamer Rachel Maddow has been practically foaming at the mouth about Trump since the announcement of the withdrawal was made. There are indeed some exceptions among genuine liberals who actually have a conscience rather than just a bunch of grievances, to include Rep. Tulsi Gabbard, D. Hawaii, who tweeted, "The hysterical reaction to the decision to withdraw troops from Syria is astonishing and shows just how attached to war some are. Lindsey Graham and others want us to continue our regime change war in Syria and to go to war with Iran. That's why they were so upset. But in general, reliable leftists have become invisible regarding withdrawing from Syria, a complete reversal to what they were saying some months ago when Trump seemed prepared to stay the course. As a completely unscientific survey of liberal opinion on the issue, I cruised through the names of the many friends I have on Facebook that are of progressive persuasion and could not find a single one who was supporting the president. Hypocrisy, Obama's belligerency, including Syria, which he turned into a war and almost succeeded in escalating into something much bigger, is given a pass while anything Trump does is sheer unmitigated evil. Trump is under intense pressure from all sides to reverse his decision on Syria and also regarding Afghanistan, which will see a 50% reduction in force. But it is up to all Americans who care about the future of this country to speak up in support of ending the wars that have bled us for the past 17 years. If liberals and neocons cannot bear the thought of supporting a president they loathe who is actually doing something right for a change, we will all regret the failure to end the cycle of war and retribution that has roiled the Middle East since the United States invaded Iraq based on lies in 2003, Trump abandoning the Kurds to make a deal with Turkey, by Richard Walker. The Kurds have sacrificed a lot in blood to assist American special forces fighting radical Islamists in Iraq and Syria, but it now appears that, after President Donald Trump's announcement that the U.S. is pulling troops out of Syria, Washington will abandon Syria's Kurds after years of propping them up. The Syrian Kurds are facing the real prospect that Turkey will drive them from the east of the country. In the north, they may soon find themselves at the mercy of a rejuvenated Syrian government in Damascus that would like to control the Kurds' rich agricultural land in the north and the oil under it, numbering 30 million people scattered over Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran. The Kurds have always longed for a homeland of their own. They thought they might get one when the Ottoman Empire collapsed, but they were deceived and denied nationhood by the British, who took over much of the region. Over the past century, the Kurds have been victims of power plays by big nations, and, in 2018, it was no different. In Syria, the Kurds had hoped that their alliance with the US would not only deliver them from Syrian control but also from Turkey. Once the war against ISIS came to an end, the Kurds fear the Turks as much as Assad, because Turkish President Recep Erdogan has regularly made it clear he wants to crush the Kurds and push them well away from the Syrian-Turkish border, arguing without evidence that Syrian Kurds are aligned with Turkish Kurds who have fought an insurgency within Turkey. Washington has publicly rebuked Turkey for making the allegation, calling it false. That does not deter Erdogan, who sees himself dominating the region and creating a new Ottoman Dawn. The writing was on the wall earlier this year that the Trump administration might abandon the Kurds in return for better relations with NATO ally Turkey. In January, Turkey launched a military assault on Afrin, a town close to the Turkish border that the Kurds had seized from ISIS. The United States did not intervene, and the Kurds were forced to flee after losing a lot of men. The Turkish invasion followed a messy political period when Washington promised to create a border force to ensure there would be no clashes between Turkish and Kurdish forces. When Turkey protested the proposal, delivered by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Washington backed down, and the Turks launched the Afrin attack. For some observers, Afrin signaled that Washington would cut and run if the Turks moved against the Kurds. There were whispered suggestions that U.S. generals were angry that their Kurdish allies were betrayed for a vague political objective, which may simply have been establishing better relations with Erdogan. An estimated 2,000 U.S. personnel, many of them contractors and special forces, remain in Syria supposedly to help mop up the last ISIS holdouts. The Pentagon has publicly warned Turkey that its threats to launch strikes against the Kurds could endanger Americans. But Turkish officials counter that Washington has secretly given Erdogan the green light to launch more strikes. If this is true, it further reinforces a belief in many parts of the region that Washington cannot be trusted. That could reverberate in Iraq, while there is a growing clamor for the U.S. to leave. A European intelligence source has confirmed to American Free Press that there has been an ongoing struggle between the Pentagon, the White House, and U.S. allies over what to do about Syria. Pentagon hawks and generals in the Middle East who have argued that leaving Syria will open the playing field to Russia, Turkey, and Iran. Trump contends that it is time to get out of Syria in keeping with promises he made during 2016 to bring home U.S. military personnel once ISIS was defeated. The problem is that not everyone agrees that ISIS is defeated. The source also revealed that U.S. allies in NATO have quietly pleaded with the White House not to be hasty in declaring an end to operations in Syria. When Trump announced on December 19, via a tweet, that ISIS was defeated, and he was pulling U.S. troops out of Syria, there was immediate blowback within the Pentagon and the military. The president's message was subsequently adjusted to indicate the withdrawal would not be immediate. Finally, the real Donald Trump, America First, should support the president's move to end U.S. involvement in Syria. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. Donald Trump won the 2016 Republican primaries in a landslide by speaking honestly about the disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Candidate Trump even said, "Elect me and you'll find out who really did 9/11. He hinted that the Saudis, close associates of the Bush family, were behind it, and he spoke of a deep state that secretly orchestrates America's wars. For these and other reasons, many patriotic Americans chose to overlook Trump's personal and political failings. They saw Trump as the second coming of the America First movement, and they hoped he would start pulling American troops out of the various quagmires in which they are slowly sinking, and instead focus on protecting America's borders and the interests of its working people." On all of these counts, Trump's first 2 years were a disappointment. Instead of revealing the truth about 9/11, Trump continued the cover-up. Instead of declassifying JFK assassination records on schedule, Trump cited national security and kept them secret. Instead of cracking down on the Saudis, Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner became their bosom buddies and business partners. Throughout his first 2 years, Trump, guided by Kushner and his handlers, consistently put Israel, not America, first. Following Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's orders, Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, shredded the nuclear deal with Iran, and declared economic war on Iran. He has let Israel continue stealing U.S. military and trade secrets and selling them to America's biggest rival, China. Some even speculate that Trump is the tool of an Israeli effort to take down the United States as the world's leading Zionist puppet superpower and put China in its place. Netanyahu's decision to grant China control of the port of Haifa, which ushers Chinese power into the Mediterranean, lends credence to that interpretation. But just as patriotic America First Trump voters were beginning to think they had been taken for a ride, the real Trump stepped up with a courageous decision that put him squarely in the crosshairs of the deep state. On December 19, Trump announced the rapid and complete pullout of U.S. troops from Syria. The reaction from both the liberal and neoconservative branches of the deep state was swift and shrill. The New York Times editorialized that abrupt and dangerous decision, detached from any broader strategic context or any public rationale, sowed new uncertainty about America's commitment to the Middle East, its willingness to be a global leader, and Mr. Trump's role as commander-in-chief. The hardline neocon Zionist outlet Commentary ran an even more hysterical piece headlined "Trump's Syrian Retreat, a Disaster in the Making." The claim made by the Times that Trump's pullout lacked strategic context or any public rationale was false. Trump's public rationale, of course, was that ISIS has been defeated, but the real reason or strategic context for the pullout is that the only U.S. proxies in Syria, radical Kurdish separatists, are inevitably going to clash with the Turkish as well as Syrian governments, and there is no good reason to put U.S. troops in the line of fire. No compelling U.S. national interest would be served by doing so. Yes, the U.S. empire will suffer a public relations defeat by retreating abjectly from Syria and allowing the Russians, Turks, Iranians, and especially the Syrians themselves to hammer out a compromise settlement, and the Israeli Zionists will also suffer, since the victorious Assad government owes its existence to the Hezbollah and Iranian fighters who helped defeat Israel's ISIS friends. Iran and Hezbollah presumably will not be leaving Syria, much less Lebanon, anytime soon, but the retreat of the U.S. empire and its Zionist overlords could become a victory for the American Republic, especially if Trump follows his instincts and pulls out of Iraq and Afghanistan, too. According to deep state asset Bob Woodward's anti-Trump book Fair, Trump has wanted to pull out of both countries ever since he became president. Only continuous browbeating, trickery, and implied threats by deep state partisans in and around the White House has prevented Trump from following his isolationist inclinations, Woodward's sources suggest. Does the Syria pullout represent the emergence of the real Trump? Will pullouts from Afghanistan and Iraq follow? If Trump really wants to make America great again, he should follow these pullouts by bringing U.S. forces home from all overseas military bases and announce a New Deal-scale plan to rebuild America's crumbling infrastructure. Some newly repatriated troops could work on this infrastructure initiative, which could be paid for by nationalizing the Federal Reserve and issuing currency directly, rather than by borrowing it at compound interest from private bankers. Will Trump dare defy the deep state to such an extent? One can only hope. War with China in a win scenario. U.S. allegedly has the capability to defeat Chinese military, but at what cost? By Richard Walker. Despite gloomy predictions that the U.S. could lose a war with China in the South China Sea, the reality is that the U.S. military has all the weapons to defeat its Chinese counterpart. Though the cost in lives and the subsequent political and economic fallout from a war of that magnitude would be devastating, there is also the unquantifiable and horrifying possibility that a conventional conflict could spiral into a nuclear exchange, which would impact all life on Earth. When warnings were made in Congress this year that America could lose a war with China or Russia, the immediate reaction in many sections of the media was to assume the worst and to focus on a potential conflict with China as the most likely one to occur in the near future. It is true, of course, that there is a greater risk of a war breaking out in the South China Sea than one with Russia in Eastern Europe. One with China would spread quickly into the Pacific region. In recent years, China had been militarizing the South China Sea, through which 100,000 merchant ships pass annually. China regards the South China Sea as its own, its aim being to control all the energy resources within it to the exclusion of the rights of neighboring countries like Vietnam. But the Chinese military strategy has a dual purpose. In placing bases and advanced weaponry on islands throughout the South China Sea, it is preparing for a conflict with the U.S. military. The islands would not only be a defensive chain to create a barrier between mainland China and the Pacific, but a staging ground for the Chinese to use their massive arsenal of short-range ballistic missiles to attack U.S. bases like Guam and U.S. aircraft carriers. There is no question that China militarily has the means to inflict serious damage to U.S. forces, but it has to be remembered that China has not fought a war since it invaded Vietnam in 1979, and that was a short conflict. America, in contrast, has the kinds of capabilities China lacks, both in terms of military experience as well as strength in the air, on the sea and under the waves, in the field of cyber and drone warfare, as well as command and control. It has the targeting precision China lacks. While China may imagine its chain of militarized island outposts represents a major threat to the U.S., the Pentagon has made it clear those islands will be wiped out at the beginning of a conflict. In May 2016, Lieutenant General Kenneth McKenzie, the director of the Joint Staff, made it clear to China that the U.S. military would adjust that. "We have a lot of experience in the Second World War, taking down small islands that are isolated," he said. "It's a core competency of the U.S. military that we've done before. A conventional war with China might be long and drawn out with considerable damage done to its military assets within China. The U.S. would use its air power and missiles to devastate Chinese military infrastructure. There would also be a massive cost in lives, especially if China decided to attack Taiwan, Japan, and the Philippines, or sought to engage India, another U.S. ally. It is impossible to predict how such a war could be ended without one side capitulating, and, during such a war, because of the long supply lines needed to sustain U.S. forces, Washington would need the unquestioned support of allies in the region and of people back home. Few military experts who understand the capabilities of both sides doubt that the United States has the capability to win. and all agree the cost in lives will be astronomical and the risk of such a conflict going nuclear cannot be ruled out. America's massive nuclear edge means it could quickly overwhelm China with nuclear strikes just from its submarines in the Pacific. China, on the other hand, lacks the intercontinental ballistic missile strength to impose equivalent damage on the U.S. But whatever happens, the costs would be terrible, and the nuclear fallout would eventually affect everyone. No one should doubt the fact that there is a growing drumbeat in Washington for the U.S. to degrade China's military power before it becomes impossible to achieve the goal. Since Chinese President Xi Jinping came to power, he has played a game of military chess, promising on the one hand Presidents Barack Obama and now President Donald Trump that China has no strategy for militarizing the South China Sea while doing just that on a scale never seen before. But what options does the U.S. have? Senior U.S. generals and strategists contend that Xi has given his military the task of preparing for a war with the United States and that the building of fortifications on island chains is designed to create operating bases to attack the U.S. fleet and U.S. bases in the Pacific when a conflict begins. Senator Marco Rubio, RFLA, is convinced it is time for the U.S. military to devise a plan to destroy all island fortifications maintained by China should war break out. He argues that, if China thinks the U.S. does not have the stomach to confront it, it will become unstoppable. His reasoning is that, if the U.S. does not prepare for a war in the region, it will be driven from it. America can fight two cold wars. America First should support the president's move to end U.S. involvement in Syria, by Patrick J. Buchanan. Kim Jong-un, angered by the newest U.S. sanctions, is warning that North Korea's commitment to denuclearization could be imperiled and we could be headed for exchanges of fire. Iran, warned Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, is testing ballistic missiles that are forbidden to them by the UN Security Council. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has warned that, within days, he will launch a military thrust against U.S.-backed Kurdish forces in northern Syria, regarding them as allies of the PKK terrorist organization inside Turkey. Russian President Vladimir Putin just flew two 160 nuclear-capable bombers to Venezuela. Ukraine claims Russia is amassing tanks on its border. How did the United States, triumphant in the Cold War, find itself beset on so many fronts? First, by intervening militarily and repeatedly in a Mideast where no vital U.S. interest was imperiled, and thereby ensnaring ourselves in the Muslim region's forever war. Second, by extending our NATO alliance deep into Eastern Europe, the Balkans, and the Baltics, thereby igniting a Cold War with Russia. Third, by nurturing China for decades before recognizing she was becoming a malevolent superpower whose Asia-Pacific ambitions could be realized only at the expense of friends of the United States. The question, then, for our time is this: can the U.S. pursue a Cold War policy of containment against both of the other great military powers, even as we maintain our Cold War commitments to defend scores of countries around the globe? And, if so, for how long can we continue to do this, and at what cost? Belatedly, the U.S. establishment has recognized the historic folly of having chaperoned China onto the world stage and seeking to buy her lasting friendship with $4 trillion in trade surpluses at our expense since President George H.W. Bush. Consider how China has reciprocated America's courtship. She has annexed the South China Sea, built air and missile bases on half a dozen disputed islets, and told U.S. ships and planes to stay clear. She has built and leased ports and bases from the Indian Ocean to Africa. She has lent billions to poor Asian and African countries like the Maldives, and then demanded basing concessions when these nations default on the debts owed for building their facilities. She has sent hundreds of thousands of students to U.S. colleges and universities, where many have allegedly engaged in espionage. She kept her currency below market value to maintain her trade advantage and entice U.S. corporations to China where they are shaken down to transfer their technology secrets. China has engaged in cyber theft of the personnel files of 20 million U.S. federal applicants and employees. She apparently thieved the credit card and passport numbers of 500 million guests at Marriott hotels over the years. She has sought to steal the secrets of America's defense contractors, especially those working with the Navy whose 7th Fleet patrols the Western Pacific off China's coast. She is believed to be behind the cybersecurity breaches that facilitated the theft of data on the US F-22 and F-35, information now suspected of having played a role in Beijing's development of its 5th-generation stealth fighters. Christians are persecuted in China, and Beijing has established internment camps for the Uyghur minority, where these Turkic Muslim peoples are subjected to brainwashing with Chinese propaganda. China's interests, as manifest in her behavior, are thus in conflict with U.S. interests, and the notion that we should continue to cede her an annual trade surplus at our expense of $400 billion seems an absurdity. We have, for decades, been financing the buildup of a communist China whose ambition is to expel us from East Asia and the Western Pacific, achieve dominance over peoples we have regarded as friends and allies since World War II, and to displace us as the world's first power. Yet if engagement with China has failed and left us facing a new adversary with 10 times Russia's population, and an economy nearly 10 times Russia's size, what should be our policy? Can we, should we, pursue a Cold War with Russia and China, using Kennan's containment policy and threatening war if U.S. red lines are crossed by either or both? Should we cut back on our treaty commitments, terminating U.S. war guarantees until they comport with what are true vital U.S. interests? Should we, faced with two great power adversaries, do as President Richard Nixon did and seek to separate them? If, however, we conclude, as this city seems to be concluding, that the long-term threat to U.S. interests is China, not Putin's Russia, President Donald Trump cannot continue a trade relationship that provides the Communist Party of Xi Jinping with a yearly $400 billion trade surplus, for that would constitute a policy of almost suicidal appeasement. Senate vote to pull U.S. troops out of Yemen was important. By Dr. Ron Paul in early December, something historic happened in the Senate. For the first time in 45 years, a chamber of Congress voted to pull U.S. forces from a military conflict under the 1973 War Powers Act. While there is plenty to criticize in the War Powers Act, in this situation it was an important tool used by a broad Senate coalition to require President Donald Trump to end U.S. participation in the Saudi war against Yemen. And while the resolution was not perfect, there were huge loopholes. It has finally drawn wider attention to the U.S. administration's dirty war in Yemen. The 4-year Saudi war on neighboring Yemen has left some 50,000 dead, including many women and children. We've all seen the horrible photos of school buses blown up by the Saudis, using U.S. supplied bombs loaded into U.S. supplied aircraft. Millions more face starvation as the infrastructure is decimated and the ports have been blocked to keep that humanitarian aid. Stopping U.S. participation in this brutal war is by itself a wise and correct move, even if it comes years too late. The Senate vote is also about much more than just Yemen. It is about the decades of presidential assaults on the Constitution in matters of war. Trump is only the latest to ignore Article I, Section 8 of the Constitution, which grants war power exclusively to Congress. Yes? It was President Barack Obama who initially dragged the U.S. illegally into the Yemen war, but Trump has only escalated it, and to this point Congress has been totally asleep. Fortunately, that all changed last week with the Senate vote. Unfortunately, members of the House will not be allowed to vote on their own version of the Senate resolution. Republican leadership snuck language into a rule vote on the farm bill prohibiting any debate on the Yemen war for the rest of this congressional session. As Rep. Thomas Massey, RCI, correctly pointed out, the move was both unconstitutional and illegal. However, as is often the case in bipartisan Washington, there is plenty of blame to go around. The Republicans were able to carry the vote on the rule, and thus deny any debate on Yemen, only because a group of Democrats crossed over and voted with Republicans. Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer, MD, is being blamed by progressives for his apparent lack of interest in holding his party together. Why would Democrats help a Republican president keep his war going? Because, especially when you look at congressional leadership, both parties are pro-war and pro-executive branch overreach. They prefer it to be their president who is doing the overreaching, but they understand that sooner or later they'll be back in charge. As I have often said, there is too much bipartisanship in Washington, not too much partisanship. Americans should be ashamed and outraged that their government is so beholden to a foreign power, in this case Saudi Arabia, that it would actively participate in a brutal war of aggression. Participating in this war against one of the world's poorest countries is far from upholding American values. We should applaud and support the coalition in the Senate that voted to end the war. They should know how much we appreciate their efforts. Lawsuit filed to shut down book on Sandy Hook school shooting, by Dave Gahery. A book familiar to some AFP readers is In the Sights of a Father of a Child Killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School Shooting in Connecticut on December 14, 2012. According to a December 4th Associated Press article entitled Sandy Hook Father Sues Authors Who Promote Conspiracy Theory, Leonard Posner has filed another defamation lawsuit against conspiracy theorists who accused him of being an actor. The book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, It Was a FEMA Drill to Promote Gun Control, claims that the proof it was a drill was obvious, from the sign reading Everyone Must Check In, to the porta potties, to the boxes of bottled water and pizza cartons, and to people wearing name tags on lanyards. It also claims that the proof it wasn't a massacre was clear as well, from no surge of EMTs into the building, no medevac helicopters, no string of ambulances to the school, no evacuation of the 469 other students, and no bodies placed on triage tarps. Additionally, the book claims the school had been closed years earlier, so no children were present in the school, and consequently, no children could have died. Posner filed suit on November 27 in Dane County, Wisk against the editors of the book, James Fitzarn, Mike Polachek, and the book's publisher, who is also the writer of this article. Dane County is the county where Fetzer resides. Polachek is in Minnesota, and the publisher, Wrongs Without Remedies LLC, is in Florida. Posner resides in Florida as well. Posner's defamation lawsuit claims that, S. Hartley, after the Sandy Hook shooting, conspiracy theorists began to claim that, my son, was not killed in the tragedy, that plaintiff was not, his, father, and that plaintiff was complicit in a grand conspiracy to fake the massacre. Plaintiff undertook effort to respond to and debunk such falsehoods, and such effort is ongoing today. Those efforts included releasing his, son's, death certificate to rebut claims that his son was not killed at Sandy Hook. The book claims the death certificate is a forgery. As Posner is now a public figure, his odds of prevailing in the suit are slim, mostly due to the 1964 U.S. Supreme Court decision New York Times Company v. Sullivan. In that case, Wikipedia explains, it was determined that the malice standard requires that the plaintiff in a defamation case, if that person is a public official or a public figure, prove that the publisher of the statement in question knew that the statement was false or acted in reckless disregard of its truth or falsity. Because of this extremely high burden of proof on the plaintiff, and the difficulty of proving the defendant's knowledge and intentions, such claims by public figures rarely prevail. Deep state ignores culpability of Obama, Hillary and Michigan, by Donald Jeffries. The mainstream media and high-profile Democratic Party politicians continue to push the fantasy that Russia colluded with the Trump presidential campaign in order to deny deep state favorite Hillary Clinton the Oval Office. As Princeton professor Stephen F. Cohen noted in a recent article in The Nation, this has served to all but shackle Donald Trump as a crisis negotiator with Russian President Vladimir Putin. This past July, Trump was widely blasted by the establishment for committing treason simply by meeting with Putin in Helsinki. Special counsel Robert Mueller has been investigating alleged connections between the Trump campaign and Russian officials since May 2017. However, recently even a source as unfriendly to Trump as National Public Radio had to admit that Mueller's case looks weaker than ever, and journalist Michael Isakoff, author of the fanciful book Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump, admitted that many of the allegations in the so-called Steele dossier, which claimed that Russia possessed incriminating material about Trump, will never be proven and are likely false. Trump quickly took to Twitter in the wake of Isakoff's comments, and declared, Michael Isakoff was the first to report dossier allegations and now seriously doubts the dossier claims. The whole Russian collusion thing was a hoax, while the mainstream media and its late-night sycophantic talk show hosts continue to harp on Russiagate fantasies. Much more credible evidence linking the previous Obama administration to efforts at disseminating material designed to link Trump to Russian officials has been routinely ignored by them. In late December, Judicial Watch released two different batches of State Department documents, which were heavily redacted in customary U.S. government manner. The documents revealed that classified information was sent to several members of the Senate, just prior to Trump's inauguration. These documents demonstrate how the Obama State Department was frantically handing out this information to Democratic senators like Ben Cardin of Maryland and Mark Warner of Virginia, as well as friendly Republicans like Tennessee's Robert Corker. A chain of emails in early January 2017 revealed that Obama Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland was attempting to send documents supposedly linking Trump and the Russians to Warner. In one email later that month, the Herculean effort was acknowledged with comments, literally only hours before Trump was inaugurated, like, "We made the deadline, and thank you everyone for what was truly a department-wide effort." These documents show remarkable evidence of the non-stop, unethical effort in the Obama State Department to gather and send its own dossier of classified information on Russia in an effort to discredit the incoming Trump administration. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton stated, as far back as February 13, even the Washington Post could declare, in an opposite the editorial page headline, "The media is ignoring ties between the Clinton campaign and Russians." The article pointed out the fact that Christopher Steele, author of the notorious dossier, was paid with money from the Clinton campaign. Steele was known to be closely allied with Bill Clinton aide Sidney Savicius Blumenthal and Jonathan Weiner, a former staffer to John Kerry. These alliances received scant attention in the mainstream media, when compared to the press given to Donald Trump Jr. meeting once with a Russian lawyer, or the highly dubious allegations of collusion against Trump supporters like Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, and Jerome Corsi. To quote from the story, "When the Democrats and their allies in the media insist that we need to know what the Russians did to influence the election and interfere in the democratic process, it is fair to ask which Russians are they talking about? Are they talking about the Russians who were solicited by Steele and his Democrat paymasters? What were the Russians' interests and were any of them paying Steele?" In 2015, the establishment's newspaper of record, The New York Times, reported that Uranium One, a Canadian company that had been acquired by the Russian atomic energy agency Rosatom in a merger approved by a consortium of government agencies, including Hillary Clinton's State Department, had donated over $2 million to the Clinton Foundation, which was not publicly disclosed by the Clintons. In another instance, a Russian bank with ties to the Kremlin, which was promoting Uranium One stock, paid Bill Clinton $500,000 for a speech in Moscow. As Trump himself noted, "Hillary Clinton gave them 20% of our uranium, gave Russia, for a big payment. It shouldn't be a crime to talk with private citizens, or even public officials, from another country. That used to be called diplomacy," and mainstream inferences of impropriety or illegality in this regard have been inconsistent, to say the least. Capital H. Senator Rand Paul puts a hold on Israeli handout by Mark Anderson. Senator Rand Paul, RCAI, placed a hold on the U.S. Israel Security Assistance Authorization Act of 2018 and is persevering in his effort to stall or block this bill. The legislation, S-2497, would provide Israel with $38 billion in official military aid over the next decade. The package was conceived during the latter days of the Obama administration. News and research outfit If Americans Knew, which documents Israeli atrocities against Palestinians and charts the amount and impact of U.S. aid to Israel, called Paul's action a historic move while noting that Paul had considered filibustering the aid package. The Senate initially adopted the Israeli funding legislation on August 1, and the House followed suit September 12. But because the bill underwent some changes on the House side, the Senate must give it final approval before it's sent to President Donald Trump. Recalling Obama's handiwork, The modified version of S-2497 itself states, in part, the 2016 Memorandum of Understanding reflected United States' support of Foreign Military Financing, FMF, grant assistance to Israel over the 10-year period beginning in fiscal year 2019 and ending in fiscal year 2028. FMF grant assistance would be at a level of $3.3 billion annually, totaling $33 billion, the largest single pledge of military assistance ever and a reiteration of the seven-decade, unshakable, bipartisan commitment of the United States to Israel's security. Since some aid has been sent to Israel already, $33 billion evidently is the remainder. Furthermore, all the congressional floor votes on this bill so far have been voice votes, where no record is made of individual votes, thus enabling all House and Senate members to avoid individual accountability. Among the most powerful lobbies on Capitol Hill, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, commonly known as AIPAC, in an August 2 news release, revealingly noted, this bipartisan legislation authorizes increases in U.S. security assistance to Israel and it encourages expanded weapons stockpiles and new U.S.-Israel cooperation in anti-drone technologies, cybersecurity, and space. Paul also placed a hold on another bill designed to punish the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which encourages citizens and organizations to withdraw support for investments in Israel. That legislation federally supports state and local measures that prohibit contracts with individuals and companies that boycott Israel. Around 27 states have already passed these types of laws in violation of Americans' First Amendment right to free speech. Media ramps up attacks on Assange. Mainstream reporter conjures up link to Trump associate with zero evidence. By St. Patrick, London's left-leaning Guardian newspaper has unofficially declared war on Julian Assange, the founder of whistleblowing organization WikiLeaks. On November 27, Luke Harding wrote an article for The Guardian accusing former Trump campaign official Paul Manafort of having met with Assange at least three times. These meetings, according to sources, were to have taken place in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Assange resided in political asylum. The final meeting between Manafort and Assange was said to have taken place in the spring of 2016. When Manafort was made campaign manager for Donald Trump, the implication of the story is that Manafort met with Assange regarding the release of hacked Democratic National Committee (DNC) emails that Russian agents had stolen. According to the questionable Steele dossier, Manafort was the key player in a well-developed conspiracy of cooperation between the 2016 Trump campaign and covert Russian agents. He currently awaits sentencing in a jail in Alexandria, Va. Harding is a foreign correspondent for The Guardian and the author of WikiLeaks, Inside Julian Assange's War on Secrecy. The book was turned into the film The Fifth Estate, which drew objections from WikiLeaks, citing that Assange never rushed to print without redactions. Harding also authored The Snowden Files, a 2014 work about whistleblower Edward Snowden. It, too, was adapted into a film, Snowden. Though his written works have received critical acclaim, his recent column pairing Manafort and Assange may be 2018's biggest fake news story. Some responsible Democrats have pointed out the obvious holes in the story. Tommy Veeder, a former national security aide to President Barack Obama, noted, if these meetings happened, British intelligence would almost certainly have video of him entering and exiting. However, no such video exists. There is also no log of Manafort entering or exiting the embassy, which would have been regular protocol. Democrats and mainstream media talking heads have jumped on the story to turn attention away from the failed campaign of 2016. Shining the spotlight on Trump via Manafort also keeps the attention away from the contents of the emails themselves, which show collusion within the Democratic Party to keep the nomination away from Senator Bernie Sanders, IVT. The criticism also serves as a dog whistle to the liberal elite. The intention is to deeply discredit Assange, and by extension the WikiLeaks organization, in the eyes of right-thinking liberals, wrote Jonathan Cook of Consortium News, that, in turn, will make it much easier to silence Assange and the vital cause he represents. The use of new media to hold to account the old, corporate media and political elites through the imposition of far greater transparency. If the DNC email hacking originated from the DNC, then the party would have much explaining to do. The revelation of an inside job would also throw the Seth Rich murder case wide open. Assange has insinuated that the hacked emails came from Rich and were the reason for his murder. Harding's story also serves to further the attacks on Assange, himself, from an elite media that feels a sense of entitlement about their craft. Veteran journalistic elitists have long made the assertion that Assange is neither a journalist nor a publisher. If he, then, is neither, he should not be allowed the same First Amendment freedoms as other American journalists or foreign journalists operating in America. Worse yet, he could potentially be labeled an unregistered foreign agent. The Justice Department has already secretly filed charges against Assange. To chip away at his right to declare constitutional protections would be to further injure his case when extradited to the U.S. for trial. In what would be one of the worst miscarriages of justice in American history, Assange could foreseeably spend the rest of his life in a federal prison. It is Trump's Justice Department that filed the charges against Assange, leading supporters to believe that the chance of a presidential pardon is nil. If Assange winds up in an American prison, we will know that the deep state has won. If the Trump administration lubricates that path, then we also have to question the legitimacy of his fight against the shadow government and the mainstream media. In the end, a jailed Assange, an exiled Snowden, and a statement that disseminators of information online are not constitutional journalists would be the greatest gift of all for those establishment journalists that Trump purports to despise. Put aside partisan animosity and admit Trump's successes. By Dr. Adrian Krieg to all the so-called never-Trumpers out there, try to remember what President Donald Trump has accomplished in 2 years, almost all without congressional support. Here's a quick rundown. Prior to Trump, economic growth was stagnant. Today, it's 4.2%, and, for the first time in a decade, economic growth is over 3%. Since 2016, 3.5 million new jobs have been created with the highest job participation rate since 1950. Unemployment claims are at a 50-year low. Unemployment among blacks, Hispanics, and women is at its lowest level in 65 years. Veterans' unemployment is also at its lowest level in two decades. Median income is now up to $61,372, up from $54,462 in 2014. Median middle-class income is also up by 3.3% at the end of 2017. In 2018, some 3.9 million Americans have gone off of the food stamps program. The poverty rate among blacks and Hispanics is at its lowest level ever recorded. Consumer confidence is at an 18-year high. Overseas investment in America is at an all-time high. In 2017 and 2018, retail sales increased by 6.4%. In the past 2 years, Trump's policy of deregulation has canceled thousands of regulatory measures enacted under then-President Barack Obama. Under Trump, there have been $5.5 trillion worth of tax cuts. In addition, the child tax credit was almost doubled. As a result, 90% of Americans saw increases in their paychecks and over 3,000 private sector companies gave employees bonuses thanks to the tax cuts. Under the Trump administration, changes in the Medicare 340B program have resulted in lower drug costs. The personal Obamacare individual mandates that functioned as taxes on citizens were also eliminated. Finally, the so-called Obamacare death panels, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, were eliminated. When it comes to the judiciary, more judges have been confirmed in Trump's first year in office than at any other time during any other presidency. When it comes to border security, $1.6 billion has already been secured for the first installment on the Mexican border wall. A 14-mile stretch of the San Diego-Mexico border wall was just completed. A new program to eliminate MS-13 gangs has also been initiated. In line with that, U.S. immigration removed 226,000 illegal alien criminals. In 2017, U.S. immigration officials arrested over 127,000 illegal alien serious felons. Trump negotiated the repeal and replacement of two major free trade agreements, NAFTA and CAFTA. He withdrew the U.S. from the job-killing Trans-Pacific Partnership. He made American energy self-reliant for the first time in five decades. For the first time in four decades, Trump made America a net fossil fuel exporter. He forced NATO members to keep their promises of spending more on their own defense. He signed legislation to increase funding for veterans by $86.5 billion. He signed the VA Quality Employment Act. He fired over 4,000 VA employees for poor performance. This is more than Obama did in his 8 years in office, and it's only 2 years into the Trump administration. The search for the truth, consideration of all available theories, part of the journey. By S.T. Patrick, the rise of the Internet age has turned millions of average Americans into both amateur and professional researchers. Let us hope, for their sake, that they all fail. It's an uncommon thing to wish for failure in an era when Generation X parents have turned coddling into a Russian ballet, shielding their children from disappointment. The truth is that there's much to learn from failure, much to gain from the processes and strategies for someone whose path has been a difficult one. Analyzing the benefits of failure for Forbes magazine, William Arruda wrote, "Failure is not a step backward. It's an excellent stepping stone to success. We never learn to move out of our comfort zone if we don't overcome our fear of failure. The most progressive companies deliberately seek employees with track records reflecting both failure and success. That's because someone who survives failure has gained irreplaceable knowledge and the unstoppable perseverance born from overcoming hardship. The various truth communities have a way of eating their young, that is, if they don't ignore them out of the community first." During a recent discussion of the JFK assassination, one prominent researcher commented that we should be strict with the younger researchers in the field. We should give them what we have already found to be true. We should label for them which authors are trustworthy and which are not, and we should define the disinformation, so that they may discern truth from nonsense. For instance, it is considered nonsense in the Kennedy assassination field to believe that driver William Greer was the assassin of Kennedy. It is even more nonsensical to believe wife Jacqueline Kennedy was a significant part of the plot. You risk public shaming if you argue that Kennedy was killed because he was about to force UFO disclosure. And you are wasting breath to even suggest that the assassin's intended target was Governor John Connally. For researchers with any level of experience, these ideas are completely shunned. There are two problems with this line of thinking, however. First, the list of resolved conclusions has hastily expanded to the point where debatable items are dismissed, depending on the clique of researchers with whom you are engaged. Some now scoff at the idea that the Kennedys had any extramarital affairs, and others refuse to entertain notions that organized crime was involved at any meaningful level. The desire for resolution now becomes censorship. Second, this robs newer researchers of the discovery process. If a high school student, a college history major, a budding journalist, or an adult learner is new to the case, they should be allowed to entertain every single theory imaginable for varying lengths of time. They should be allowed to traverse through the steps of the scientific method, researching until they conclude the validity or invalidity of one theory, and then moving on to the next. They should be allowed to win and lose verbal debates with other community members. They should be allowed to read the authors in exile, finding bits and pieces of truth within the so-suggested muck. More importantly, there can be gains from thinking abstractly. When you start with a wild thesis and then work to prove or disprove it, you will stumble upon grains of truth that lead you to better theories. If the community, however, never openly allows failure, or shuns newer researchers who temporarily believe theories the experienced researchers had dropped decades ago, then we rob the newly interested of what it is to truly be a student. By extension, it is no surprise that this is where these once open-minded communities have found themselves. The desire to clone academia while concurrently despising it is powerful. The same can be said for the mainstream media. Alternative communities have disdain for the MSM while quoting it ad nauseam on the rare occasion when the two lanes merge. When weathered researchers begin to demand respect, hierarchies are created. Those at the bottom are routinely dismissed, ignored, and dissuaded. This is where we find the truth communities now. We should not forget, however, that what the 16-year-old high school student in West Frankfort, ill and the 72-year-old history professor in Berkeley, Calif. Want are the same thing. They want to seek truth on cases that are unreported or misreported by their own media. They want to challenge the faulty textbook ideologies of the conglomerates who control knowledge in schools, and they want to be a part of something real, something meaningful, so they can sleep at night. We must remember that we are on the same path and not a different one, and we must allow those who have just begun their own walk to do so at their own pace and with their own map.